You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 23rd to the 29th of May 2013. I'm joined by editor John Gill and reporters Elizabeth Gidney and David Matthews. We'll be looking, as ever, at several highlights from this week's edition, including our lead news story this week, which looks at government proposals that could see medical education and research budgets moved from the Department of Business, Innovation and Skills to the Department of Health. We'll be querying the value of having a degree, as a researcher claims that the economic advantage of doing so has dropped by 30% over the last 20 years. And finally, our cover feature this week is written by art critic and prolific feather ruffler Brian Sewell, who says that today's students are impoverished by a scant knowledge of culture and context, and makes his case for ensuring that everyone has a grounding in art history. But first to Lizzie and your splash this week on medical education and research budgets. Currently under BIS, which of course oversees universities, but possibly moving over to the DOH, the Department of Health. What's the logic behind this?
Well, this is more financial wrangling ahead of the spending review, really. So it's the basic idea is that whilst BIS is going to take a hefty, going to have a chunk out of its budget, the Department of Health, alongside also Department of International Development, have protected budgets. So this is an idea where, with a bit of cunning financial skills, you can just transfer some parts of BIS across to the Department of Health and thereby save BIS from further cuts. But a lot of other departments have been trying to do this as well. Defence, social care, they're trying to muscle in on those nice protected budgets.
Put it all under the Department of Health budget. Surely
everything.
There is a limit to the extent you can do that.
Well, indeed, indeed. So this is really what we're highlighting in the article. So these are some quite strong rumours. They're certainly being considered and they're under discussion at the moment. The question is, what would the effects be and whether people will be happy with this to go ahead? So one point, as we just made, the Department of Health can't be stretched infinitely. Whether they'll be given more funding to take into account these streams or not, we don't know, or if we'll just be squeezed out of what they already have. And obviously a huge loss of control for universities and from the Department for Growth. To lose a jewel in the crown, as I think one of our contributors calls it.
It is a way to cut the budget of BIS, though, isn't it? Because I spoke to David Willetts last week. There's a podcast of that up as well online at the minute. And any details about how they're going to make what are seemingly confirmed and quite significant cuts, very, very difficult to come by. This is one way of doing it.
Well, this is the point, is something does have to be cut. We had an article last week by John Morgan on whether that would be the £4.6 billion science ring fence or widening participation funding. So they're both two very important parts of the BIS budget, and nobody wants those to be cut either. Yeah. So it has to come from somewhere.
And you have to wonder as well, is this a way to cut the BIS budget? I mean, government budgets, obviously there's a departmental spending limit and some of them protected, some of them aren't, and individual departments are being asked to make cuts, but across the piece it has to add up to a certain amount, presumably. And if you just move a chunk to a different protected department and say that's our cut, the government or the Treasury, I wonder to see who's actually behind this. Is the Treasury, would the Treasury agree to something like this? Is it not just financial jiggery-pokery?
It actually sounds more like it's the Treasury's idea than BIS's. I think they've been convinced about the value of the science ring fence. This is my personal opinion from people I've spoken to. And so this is actually maybe more pushed from the Treasury rather than BIS. Because if you look at what we're talking about, I mean, the MRC is absolutely one of its prizes. You know, it's the Research Council where it's easiest to show impact to the public and to prove your worth, and it's got, you know, a 100-year history this year. So I would be very surprised if BIS are the ones pushing this.
I think it's an interesting reflection on how difficult actually it's going to be to cut the BIS budget in a way that sort of makes sense and also politically is palatable, because there's only a certain number of pots of cash within the BIS budget that are big enough to sort of achieve the cuts that they're asking for. And a lot of them are really untouchable, either literally untouchable because there's a ring fence around them, or because actually, for example, how could the government, which has promised students that now they're paying higher fees, they'll get a much better service and so on, how could they then go and further cut the public element of funding for teaching? It would be a really, really difficult thing to do. And it sounds slightly as though there's sort of a desperate attempt to see what can be done and
Absolutely. Well, this would be a really large portion of the cuts that would need to be made if these were to go ahead. But as Sir Steve Smith says in the piece, it looks too good to be true because it is.
The other thing that we cover this week in a leader, which was written by our news editor Simon Baker, is the fact that, as you alluded to earlier, Chris, the sort of biz as the Department for Growth looks in danger of being sort of diminished to such an extent that it almost no longer exists if all the sort of health research funding is removed. If Michael Gove is intent on moving teacher training funding out of BIS, if potentially Michael Gove, as has been suggested, wants to get his hands on higher education as part of the education department, what are you left with? I mean, this was established as a department for growth, and it slowly, in a sort of piecemeal fashion, seems to be being dismantled. Or at least that could be the impression that's given if this cut goes ahead.
Yeah, we'll watch with interest how that one develops. One of the reasons for the cuts, of course, is declining incomes, recessions and the like. David, you've got a piece this week on the value of degrees. I guess one way to boost the coffers of the government would be to have people earning more money. It doesn't seem from your research, from your article, I should say, that the degree's value is quite what it used to be in terms of earning potential.
It does not. And this is new research from Malcolm Byron, who's from the University of Essex's Institute for Social and Economic Research. And he looked at data spanning going from 1993 to 2008. What he found was basically that the returns to a degree, so the economic return you get in a job above simply having A-levels, has dropped by about 30% over that 15-year period. But the point he's also making is a kind of paradoxical one as well, is that despite degrees being worthless to degree holders, they're actually becoming more important for people to get into the job market. They're basically becoming standard, as you know, a lot of commentators have suggested. He's finding a lot of occupations used to have no graduates in them and now having more graduates in them, and some which were partly graduate, partly non-graduate, are becoming totally graduate. So socially, students are being told to get a good job, you have to have a degree, which is kind of true, and yet the rewards are actually going down.
Mm. And the prices are going up.
And exactly, the price is going up.
It's to be expected, I suppose, isn't it? If more people have a degree, then obviously the average wage perhaps will be brought down because just a lot of numbers. There's more people working at that level.
Yeah. I mean, that's basic economics, supply and demand. But the further point he makes, however, is that there's not really any reflection of that in the kind of discourse that's put out by the media, the government, and economists. So they all say, well, getting a degree will help your future earning power and what kind of job you get, but they don't sort of break that down. They always cite an average figure, which in fact a lot of graduates were no better than if they'd just done A-levels. Mm-hmm.
Of course, going further along to postgraduate, that effect is still there as far as I can tell from recent research. In fact, also you now kind of have to have a master's or some kind of postgrad to achieve that premium that perhaps you used to have just with a degree.
I think this thing also is a question of what constitutes a good job is not necessarily about how much you earn, is it? I mean, we're all sitting around the table as journalists, and actually journalism isn't particularly well paid as a profession. And certainly when I started out working in local papers, for example, when you were there, I think my starting salary was £13,000 a year as, somebody with a degree. And you sort of think, well, obviously that's a starting position and you move on from there, and please say I'm no longer earning £13,000 a year. But it is a good job, and it's a graduate job. And it's something that 30 years ago you wouldn't have had to have had a degree to get into. Now, not only do you need a degree to get into journalism, but increasingly you probably need a degree from, if not Oxbridge, something there or thereabouts. I mean, especially if you look at the national newspapers, it's infamous that you go to the likes of The Guardian or The Times and you do a sort of poll of staff there, 95% of them went to Oxbridge. So, but inevitably, it's a good job. Doesn't necessarily mean it's a very high-paid job.
I suppose you could argue, I suppose, then, maybe a degree is becoming less of an economic investment, more of a social investment. You basically pay all this money, you do 3 years, and you get a sort of bourgeois, middle-class, respectable job that maybe pays peanuts.
Get a lot more as a plumber. But
what a rosy future you paint.
Yes. there was one final very interesting piece of data I unearthed while researching this. the Brown Review, which set out the case for higher fees, it says, you know, graduates earn £100,000 more of their lifetime than non-graduates. That was actually based on research carried out in 2002. In the footnotes, it's buried in there. So perhaps we need a new government study on what the graduate premium actually is.
And that £100,000 figure is still quoted all the time, isn't it? I think David Willetts quoted it in a podcast that Chris, you did with him quite recently.
He did, yeah, he does a lot. Although I still don't know what you earn, John. You alluded to it there. Perhaps I should...
All I said was more than £13,000.
Fair enough, we'll stick with that. I should highlight another one of David's articles worth looking at this week, which reveals who male students consider to be their role models and how the role models change depending on whether students in question are working class or middle class. David Beckham, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Christopher Hitchens all feature in that one, so check it out. Finally, for this issue, however, or this episode, I should say, our cover feature is written by art critic Brian Sewell. John, I suppose I should come to you on this as editor. How and why did this piece come around? What's it all about?
This was... actually came about. I commissioned Brian Sewell to write this, having read and enjoyed his autobiography, which... he writes very interestingly about the sort of transformational part that his time at the Courtauld Institute played in his life. And it was interesting to me because the Courtauld Institute then, he studied at the time when Anthony Blunt was in charge of it. And Blunt sort of came in and took over an institution that perhaps wasn't as academically rigorous as it could have been, and sort of turned it into something that was very much of its time and of its place, and really of Anthony Blunt. He kind of created I suppose quite an elite institution where sort of chosen few sort of knelt at, you know, at the feet of the master and kind of soaked up all the expertise. And it just got me thinking about the nature of sort of small specialist institutions like that, and also of subjects like art history and what they've perhaps become today as opposed to how they kind of started out or once were. And obviously Brian Sewell is a great sort of writer and provocateur, as you alluded to earlier, and he's written a very interesting feature for us about, I suppose it's about all sorts of things, but it's about educational standards how schools prepare students for higher education, specifically in history of art, but also more generally, I suppose. And it also looks at the nature of compulsory subjects and the idea that there are certain core subjects that you absolutely have to study, you know, maths and English, for example. And he makes a case... quite persuasively, although I suspect also perhaps it's not something that's going to happen, that art history could be a really valuable compulsory subject.
English, maths, and of course that third staple.
I think he wants to ditch the maths, actually.
He wants to ditch the maths, he wants to keep the English, and he wants to introduce art history. Never going to happen. But it's a really interesting argument that actually these subjects that touch on all sorts of other... You know, he makes the case that, you know, when you're studying art history, you're learning about politics, you're learning about... even things like mathematics to a certain extent in the sort of geometry and perspective and that sort of thing.
I've heard that said about a lot of subjects. I've heard it said about music as well, because you have to learn the, you know, what the different notes means and how the degrees of difference between them. Do you buy
history
the argument?
Science tells you an awful lot as well, as someone who studied that.
Yeah. But he does make an interesting point. I hadn't thought about it before, having to pass a maths GCSE essentially to ever go to university, it's quite a barrier for some people. I have a friend who did English literature at university. He was really, really good at it, got a first, but he only just scraped a C for maths in GCSE, and if he hadn't, he may have not been able to go to uni at all. And so he does make you think about compulsory subjects. I'm not sure whether I then substitute maths for history of art, but
I have something, the tone of this somehow grates at me a little bit. As someone with a background in science and having studied a lot of maths, it just kind of seems to sum up a lot of what we hear culturally and on the radio, and the kind of Radio 4 type saying, oh, I couldn't, never had a chance at maths, you know, I'm terrible at it. And that seems culturally acceptable to say that. I mean, he actually has dyscalculia, he really, you know, medically struggles with maths, but there's a general kind of feeling out there that it's fine to say you're totally rubbish at maths. And you never say, I've not read Shakespeare, single play.
And yet also, all the official sort of lobbying, by far the most effective lobby at the moment, is for STEM subjects, isn't it? Mm. And we just had, you know, David Willetts announcing that they're going to be spending £16 million on sending someone to space, ostensibly to, you know, inspire a new generation of people to go and do STEM, because they are the subjects that the economy needs, the government, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that at all. It's probably exactly, you know, entirely appropriate. But I think having voices who are saying, actually, look, subjects that sort of raise our culture and remind people that, you know, there's more to life perhaps than simply learning something that's going to be economically useful and so on and so forth, is also entirely appropriate and good for the health of the nation.
I agree, but I think that's maybe why he should have gone beyond geometry and perspective. And there's huge swathes of mathematics and science that change the way you think, your philosophy. Mm. You just got to go a little bit deeper.
Sure. Well, sorry, David.
Yeah, he does also say that, you know, you, through the history of art, you can understand religion, conflicts, nations, dynasties, rich and powerful, middle classes and poor. And I just thought, well, why not just study history in the first place?
That's a good point. Well, we've critiqued his article. I think it's only fair we should allow Mr. Sewell a right of reply, and perhaps he's got a few words he'd like to critique this podcast with.
They did a thoroughly bad job.
Fair enough. Well, Brian Sewell there speaking to us, I should say, via the Sewell Sampler, which you'll find on briansewell.co.uk. But that's the end of this week's podcast. Do check out the edition. You'll find us on timeshighereducation.co.uk. Of course, we're in all the usual social media places as well. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on LinkedIn. We're also on Google+. Do let us know what you think, and we'll see you again next week.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.